now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're here with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
Joining us today, it is The Times' very own Bill Edgar and chief football writer Henry Winter, who is in Prague. Coming up, we're going to take a look at why Jack Ross didn't work out at Sunderland and is Trent Alexander-Arnold a wasted talent at fullback? First, though, Gareth Southgate has his boys back together and they're on the road this time. First up for the Three Lions, it's the Czech Republic on Friday before a trip to Bulgaria on Monday night. The Times chief football writer then, Henry, joins us on the line now, as I say, from the Czech Republic to take a look at the two games. We're going to start, though, with off-field matters. And a number of England's players have spoken this week about UEFA's three-step protocol at combating racism on the pitch. Is it doing enough? Well, Tammy Abraham has suggested not and implied that England will be ready to walk when they want to walk, not when they're told they can, if there were any incidents of racism on the field or from the stands. Following a team meeting, Abraham said, "It is a team thing. Don't isolate one person. We're a whole team. If it happens to one of us, it happens to all of us." We should point out UEFA have their clear three-step guidelines if racial abuse is detected. The first being stadium announcement calling for it to stop. Secondary, temporary suspension of the game with a further announcement. And finally, the abandonment of the match. Abraham did say, if we decide we want to stop the game and we want to stop the game, no matter what the score is, if we're not happy with it as a team, we will decide whether or not to stay on the pitch. It is a team decision if we decide in the end that we don't want to play this game anymore because of what is going on. Well, there is no doubt there is recent history, particularly in Bulgaria, of racism. If this does happen, Henry, and the players do walk off, this would be some statement, some example set by England to the rest of the world.
I think it's fantastic they're considering it. I mean, it's very interesting that a lot of people have been focusing on UEFA's three-step protocol, which anyone who goes to matches where there is a racist presence, just knows it simply doesn't work. Because first, is the referee going to hear it? Is he then going to say, well, was it just one person? Did I really hear it? Will the match delegate get involved as well? So I think the players are completely right, and Tammy Abraham was very forthright in his comments that they're going to ignore the three-step protocol. And if they do hear something, as happened in Montenegro, then they're going to walk off. Because, look, these are professionals. And, you know, they're representing their country. No one in any workplace should have to sort of work under those circumstances. So the fact that UEFA are hopeless on these things, we've seen the fines, we've seen the sort of the small, you know, stadium bans, you know, almost closing a row and putting a banner on it and a hashtag. You're not going to fight racists with hashtags. But what you have to do is absolutely shame them, shame the hosts, shame the national association, shame the governing bodies, and that involves the players, the ones who are bearing the brunt of it, just saying, no, enough is enough. We cannot play sport in, you know, unsporting inhuman conditions, and we're going to walk off. So what Tammy Abraham said was very interesting. And when I was with him, about sort of five or six of us were speaking to him, and I went back to Tammy and I said, listen, do you really mean this? Do you mean that you will walk off before the three-step protocol kicks in? And he said, yeah, you know, and he's quite right. Enough is enough, because this has been going on for, well, 20, 30, 40 years. And everyone said, oh, it's, you know, it's gone underground. It's calmed down. Things are much better. But clearly it hasn't. It's spilling over into social media and it's still spilling over in monkey chants and matches. And when the players walk off, I said to them, I said, listen, every journalist in this room will back you. I'm sure the Football Association will back you. UEFA will get in a huff. But something's got to be done. I think it's completely right.
It is interesting when you look at the UEFA protocols, because they're putting the onus a lot on the referee. And a referee will have to be very brave, Bill, to halt a game.
Yeah, well, as Henry said, would the referee hear? I mean, the referee's, it's not as if that's his only responsibility, running around listening out for racist chants. He's concentrating extremely hard on a match, you know, which you have to as a referee. I think the three-step protocol, I mean, it hasn't led to any matches being abandoned, but UEFA has acknowledged there have been racist chants because they've closed stadiums partially, you know, subsequently for subsequent games. So they know it's happened. They've acknowledged it's happened, but just at the time, it's not, you know, they haven't during the game. They haven't put this three-step, you know, gone through the three-step and abandoned the game. And I think, yeah, it would have a huge effect. I mean, if England were to walk off, it would have enormous send enormous shockwaves through the sporting world. It's the world's most popular sport. England, one of the most famous teams right around the world. If you had an England team had walked off in a competitive match because of racism, and it would have a massive impact. And I think it would sort of get really draw something out of UEFA. They couldn't just ignore it.
Yeah, as we say, it would be a huge statement if England were to do it, Gregor. I know in the past, earlier on this year, Raheem Sterling was asked about the same scenario, and he actually said walking off the pitch wouldn't be the right thing to do, as that would let the racists win. Slightly conflicted to what Tammy Abraham has said, and that they've all agreed that that's what they'll do. Perhaps Sterling has changed his mind. But can you understand that thought process as well from Sterling?
Yeah, I mean, look, first of all, it's very hard to understand it at all, because I'm white, and I'm not someone who's ever been on the receiving end of this. But I would also have loved to have been a kind of fly on the wall in the team meetings that have been going on this week, because it's obvious that Gareth Southgate is intent on confronting this issue. He kind of must have felt, I think he's felt helpless in the past when this has happened to his players, and he mentioned this first in the previous the previous international break, and you know, almost threw this forward to give several weeks sort of run up, and this is an issue that's overshadowed the game entirely now, and that's admirable that he wants to tackle it like this, but I think it has kind of raised the issue above the game itself, and it's probably put a bit of pressure on the players. I mean, I would have liked to have known what happened in that room, because not everyone will be unanimous about it, and obviously they've had a team meeting and they've come to an agreement, and that's why the players have made public their intention to walk off the game. But as we've said, Raheem Sterling, some people have said, I spoke to Viv Solomon Otobor, a guy who's playing in Bulgaria for CSK Sofia, and he was saying that some people they'd see scoring a goal as kind of as, you know, showing the people who are these ignorant people, that's the response some people want, and other people obviously feel that walking off the pitch is what's necessary. And as we're saying, I don't think it would have been unanimous, so it would have been very interesting to see how they have come to this decision. But Gareth Southgate, he has to be commended for tackling it head on.
Yeah, he certainly led from the front. But it is, of course, a grim reality that there is this expectation of racism, especially in Bulgaria. Extra anti-racism observers will be positioned in the Vasilevsky Stadium after it was flagged as a risk for potential abuse. There will be at least three observers in strategic positions around the stadium supplied by the Football Against Racism in Europe group, which is more than any other match in the international break. And Henry, I know you've written a piece in the Times this week calling for the players to walk at the first instance. The camp has been reminded, as we've talked about, by the UEFA protocol. Do we have any idea of the repercussions there would be should England walk off?
I think that UEFA will get huffy. They'll say this is not right. There'll be the image of the referee and maybe one or two UEFA officials chasing Harry Kane and the players down the tunnel. And I think the whole weight of the nation will get behind the England players. And it will be an FA versus UEFA thing. UEFA have to tread very carefully because they don't have a great reputation for tackling, confronting racism. Plus also the final of the competition that England are involved in at the moment, semi-final and the final are at Wembley. So the FA have got a card to play there if UEFA tried to get uppity with England. I just think there's such an appetite now. I mean, you sort of talked about that piece I wrote the other day. I mean, to be honest, I came to the conclusion about sort of 3-4 years ago. I've been writing, sadly, about racism in football for many years, including writing a book with John Barnes on it. And I've just come to the conclusion that actually the only way to deal with these people is to walk off and to actually to challenge the fans, the majority of fans who are great wherever you go, actually to challenge them who are around, who've got some racist standing next to them doing monkey chants. And if it's one person, maybe if it's a group, but actually take responsibility, the fans, for their own situation. Now, look, it's difficult because there's a threat of violence. It's their own. They maybe don't see there's anything wrong with it. But actually, they've got to do something. The fans themselves have got to look at themselves. I understand you've got to go back, and it's to do with education and socioeconomic circumstances and issues like that. But also the national associations have got to do something. Because Montenegro, their FA, was an absolute disgrace. And what was interesting when it all happened with Hudson-Odoi, Danny Rose and Raheem Sterling, when they got racially abused last season, Gareth Southgate was walking in there, and we said to him, why didn't you take the players off? And he looked really sort of troubled by the thought, maybe I should have done more for my players, because he so cares about these players. You know, he came through the system at Crystal Palace, a very diverse team when he was playing there, Brighton, Wright and individuals like that. He's very aware of these issues. And I think he's had a little bit within and thought, I've got to make a stand here. And I think I will absolutely back these players to come off. But just on your last point that you were just talking about there, Natalie, about the fact there are only three UEFA spotters listening in. I think it will be found by a sound engineer at the BBC or TalkSport or on television, whoever's showing the game, because they're the ones who are listening to the feed, who are focusing on the sound, mainly because they don't want anyone to swear, so they turn the volume down if there's particular swearing in certain areas. So I think that it'll be television probably that picks up on any racist chants first, as also the players on the pitch, because, you know, they can clearly hear. Often the photographers who are closest to it, we go and ask them afterwards, you know, the photographers that we know, said, did you hear anything? He said, no, we were so focused on the game. So it'd be interesting to see who picks it up. But if a player hears it, I hope they go straight over to the referee, go straight over to Harry Kane and said, listen, this is unacceptable, we're walking off.
You were talking about Gareth Southgate there. It was 3 years this week since he took charge of his first game as the England manager. It was a 2-0 win over Malta. The first goal was scored by Daniel Sturridge and Wayne Rooney was the captain. A lot, of course, has changed in that time, including, we can say, two major semi-finals. Henry, let me come to you. How would you rate England's rise under Southgate?
Oh, very exciting. And it's still on the rise. I mean, you look at, you know, you mentioned the semi-finals. I think he's evolving all the time. The team's getting younger. You're seeing a player like Marcus Rashford, who did well at the World Cup. He's now under pressure for his place from Jadon Sancho. You're seeing, Aaron Wan-Bissaka, when he's fit, is putting pressure on Trent Alexander, who I think is barely out of his teens. So I look at the senior team when it's selected, and I thought, oh, is that the under-21 team? And then you realise, no, this is the senior team. And then you look at the talent that's still in the under-21s. Hudson-Odoi is still there. Phil Foden is there. You know, about 2-3 years ago, probably 18 months ago, England were saying, where's the talent coming from? Look, there are issues. England still lack a sort of dynamic central midfielder. There are issues with concentration in defence. Do England have a high-class understudy if anything happens to Harry Kane? But otherwise, in the majority of positions, England are well-stocked. There are no cliques in this camp. There are no idiots. You know, one or two individuals, people say, well, why aren't they in the squad? Well, one or two of them is because maybe certain people within England don't necessarily like their attitude. So I think you've got a very, very united squad. They're completely believe in what Gareth Southgate wants to do. I think it's a better team now than it was during the World Cup when they got to the semi-finals. I think Southgate's probably a bit better as well, because he will have analysed his performance against Croatia. He didn't react to their changes in the semi-final. So I think things are very encouraging. The problem they've got is there's a fantastic Dutch team coming through. The French are obviously outstanding. That Belgian team, their second 11 could probably get to the quarterfinals of the Euros. So, you know, England are up against some really outstanding opposition. But there's a confidence there. And the most important thing that Southgate's done, as everyone's been saying, he's taken the fear out of playing for England. The shirt doesn't weigh so heavily anymore. They go out and express themselves.
Henry, really appreciate you speaking to us. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Bill, for you then, what's been the biggest change in the England we're now seeing under Gareth Southgate?
I think they've got their attacking game together. It took a couple of years. I mean, the first 2 years, I don't think the level was any better than under Hodgson. That includes the World Cup, where it was all tremendous fun. They got to the World Cup, to the semi final, but they had a very lucky draw. But I thought the big step forward was in the Nations League qualifiers, particularly the two games against Croatia, where they were by far the better team in both games. The style has developed. They're much like a top Premier League team now. I think they press hard. It's very imaginative going forward, and they've got they're happy to pick young, inexperienced players. Yeah, I mean, he's lucky, I think, in that the standard of players has gone up a little bit. But you could say he deserves some credit in that sense, because he's been involved with the youth England youth team, so he's helped nurture them a little on the international stage. So it's looking promising, more promising than it has done for a while. Although, thinking back to the Nations League finals match against Holland in the semi-final, they were quite badly outplayed, so that's a warning that there's still a while to go before they reach the very top.
Gregor, as a Scotsman, and no doubt a proud Scotsman, does it grate you that we talk so adoringly about Gareth Southgate and what he's done for England?
No, not at all. I mean, he's likeable. He's a thinker. He's, you know, it's just amazing to think as well that, you know, the circumstances in which he came into the job. Sam Allardyce was the previous England manager, and how different things could have been, you know?
Yeah.
And it's worked out brilliantly, because, as Bill alluded to, all England's success in youth age groups, there's been a sort of continuity to that process, and the players have progressed. Some of them have worked with Gareth Southgate in the under-21s and into the first team, and that is unquestionably going to be his kind of legacy, is that he's introduced a lot, this kind of generation of bristling young talent. I also think Steve Holland has to take great credit, because the evolutions that Henry spoke about there, about, you know, switching from three at the back to four at the back, and sort of making England a modern attacking force, you know. Steve Holland is the guy on the training ground who sort of hones that style of play. Another thing I think he deserves real credit for is just opening up the whole experience of being an England player. You know, remember before the World Cup, the press were invited to sit down for over an hour with all the players, and that would never have happened in the past. And it just sort of threw off the shackles and the sort of the weight of playing for England, and sort of opened the door to all the players for the whole public and the whole country as well. And that, I think that's part of the reason why there was such a good kind of feel-good feeling in the country in the summer, and it was getting really worrying for a while that you were going to win it.
I knew he was going to come back to something like that. But much of the build-up to England's game with the Czech Republic on Friday has focused on the Chelsea striker Tammy Abraham. 8 goals in 8 games in the Premier League, 9 goals in 11 in all competitions this season. England should be very excited about having him return to the international stage, because he's, what, last played for England nearly 2 years ago. Now, Gregor, you've written a piece about him this week in The Times. It looks back at his childhood, his development in the game with a wide range of youth coaches, say, at Chelsea. But was he someone, from what you've written about, was he someone that you saw was destined to make it on the big stage?
It's funny, most of the people I spoke to would say yes. But the question was always that opportunity. That was the biggest question mark at Chelsea, which is understandable, because there had been none really until this season. So, you know, one of his coaches, Adi Vivash, said to me that. He said his talent was always there. He, you know, dedicated, professional, really competitive spirit, did all the extra work, you know, great professional, and his family behind him as well. He did things like moved the whole family to Surrey to be near the Chelsea training ground when he was 16 and going full time. They really pushed for him to get out on loan when he was 18 to go to Bristol City. He thought he was ready for senior football, and obviously Bristol City and Aston Villa, he thrived. Swansea was interesting. I spoke to Paul Clement, and he said that he started really well. He scored 4 goals in his first 8 games, got that England call up, And then he had to wait until April before his next Premier League game. Clement was sacked. Carlos Carvajal came in. And Swansea were really sort of on the slide. And that was a difficult time for him. But he even referenced this week that was probably the spell in his career he learned the most. And Paul Clement was saying he had to learn to be a strong man, playing up front on his own often against two established kind of powerful centre-halves in the Premier League. And sort of learning that you're not going to have the ball all the time and be part of a team that sort of dominates possession. So it's been a lot of sort of those formative years have really kind of shaped him. And I don't think he would be the player now who's getting the opportunity at Chelsea if it wasn't for those loan moves and his dedication, undoubtedly.
I think, yeah, he's mentioned, hasn't he, that Swansea loan move made him into a man, basically. Yeah. It was a real baptism of fire. Should we be excited about Tammy Abraham from an England perspective, Bill?
Yeah, I think so, because he's got two vital ingredients that you want for a striker. He can finish really well. He's shown that with Aston Villa last season and with Chelsea this season. And he can finish in different ways, both feet and head well. But also he can hold the ball up well. So he's strong and clever and can bring other players into position. So he's not just a finisher, not just knows where to hang around in the box to finish off. So I think he's a good all-round player. And that ability to hold the ball up is important because both Chelsea and England play with just one striker. So we should be excited. At the moment, the fact that England do play with only one striker and the fact that the number one striker is Harry Kane, who's so much the number one striker, it's going to be hard for Abraham to get into the starting 11 unless Southgate changes his formation. But when Kane is injured, which unfortunately he has had a couple of spells out in recent years, Abraham is a good person to come in.
Mm. Well, when it comes to the other options then for Gareth Southgate, we know, as Bill has just said there, Harry Kane is number one. He's always going to be picked first. But there isn't much else to choose from in some ways, with Marcus Rashford perhaps not doing it for England or even for Manchester United right now. Callum Wilson perhaps isn't on form right now. So do you think, based on form, Tammy Abraham should be second choice?
Yeah, absolutely. And you wouldn't have thought you would have said that, yeah. even a month ago. But he is, undoubtedly, he's got the kind of goal scorer's instinct, I think. And that's what, again, people I spoke to, Lee Johnson said that, he's the Bristol City manager, he said the thing he sort of remembered most was whenever players were moving away from the goal, he was moving towards the goal. And he would often throw out his big sort of long lanky legs and get on the end of things that he never thought in a million years he was going to touch. And he said, that's, you can tell that he's a product of his environment, but he's also got an instinct about him as well. And I admitted a few weeks ago that I didn't think he was this good. I think quite a lot of people would have been in that same boat. He was prolific in the Championship, but that season at Swansea was very tough for him. And even in some games in the Championship, I would see, just look at his all-round play and his part in sort of in constructing attacks and holding the ball up and stuff like that. I thought there was stuff to work on, but he's been magnificent this season, and he's definitely, if Harry Kane was not to play, he'd be the second in choice, definitely.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, Jamie Carragher has suggested that Trent Alexander-Arnold could eventually become Liverpool's answer to Kevin De Bruyne. The 21-year-old scored one goal and made 12 assists in 29 Premier League games last season, whilst he's already netted once and created two goals this term. Steven Gerrard was used as a right-back in the very early stages of his career, so could we see Alexander-Arnold follow in the former Liverpool and England skipper's footsteps, Gregor?
I think he has the capability, that's the first thing to say. There's two strands to this. The first is he good enough to play midfield? And the answer is undoubtedly, he is. I've said this already, I think he's the most sort of technically complete English footballer around just now. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about all the wingers, you know, Hudson-Odoi and Sancho and people like Tammy Abraham. There's no one who is technically as complete as Alexander-Arnold. Sometimes when he sort of hits those raking crossfield passes, I just swoon. It's just absolutely, you know, natural, pure strike of the football. All right, I'm gushing now.
Yeah.
No, he is. But so the first thing is, yes, he could play in centre midfield. The second thing is, would that make him more effective for Liverpool? And that's the million-dollar question, because the way Liverpool play, fullbacks are a huge part, him and Andy Robertson on either flank. And there's not really many people better at crossing a ball than him. And I'm not sure he would get in as many of those positions if he was playing in midfield for Liverpool. Liverpool's midfield is essentially the engine of the team. It's not actually the creative sort of spark of it. Mm. So unless that was to change, I think he should persist with playing at right back. He's been compared to, you know, Jamie Carragher was talking about Kevin De Bruyne. And I was looking before, he played an average of 3.5 key passes a game, Trent Alexander-Arnold. Kevin De Bruyne is just over 4, and they're about the same in number of crosses per game as well. So he's almost being as effective as De Bruyne is now from fullback. I don't know. In the future, he might turn it to. I think he could be as influential and as sort of good as Steven Gerrard for Liverpool. He's that good, yeah.
It's interesting because he actually started in the academy as a midfielder at Liverpool, and then has been put into the right back position now. So he has that versatility that he could, if needed, drop in or move up into the midfield positions.
Yeah, to call kind of withdrawing his the memory of his past. Yeah. You do often wonder if it's worth, say, in pre-season or whatever, just moving the team around, getting everybody to play in different positions, just to see if anybody would actually thrive in a different position. Because quite often you'll stick in the same position for your whole career. You might just be a winger who would do well in centre midfield or whatever.
Adam Lallana did that, I think, in the build up to the Champions League final. Okay. They were playing a sort of 11v11, and I think the sort of other 11 were trying to replicate the opposition, and Lallana played in a sort of bit more of a deep lying role in midfield, and apparently everyone was like, "Oh, this could be something in this." So that was something that was spoken about at the start of the season. So I think it might happen occasionally. Mm. I would be very surprised if Jurgen Klopp hasn't got this in his mind, but he's got to find a right back as sort of
as
productive as Alexander-Arnold, and as we've said, those fullbacks are so key for the way Liverpool play.
There is a tradition of fullbacks doubling up as centre midfielders. Having said that, there's Bill Neville and Daley Blint, Manchester United. Giovanni Van Bronckhorst did it at Arsenal. Then there's a couple of Bayern Munich players, Joshua Kimmich, now Philipp Lahm in the past. So they've shown it's been possible. Usually they've gone from fullback to defensive centre midfield as opposed to attacking centre midfield. Although I can think of one example, David Alaba, also Bayern Munich, who's played, you know, attacking centre midfield for Austria. If we're thinking of Alexander-Arnold as a kind of number 10 attacking midfielder, as Gregor said there, Liverpool's system is 4-3-3, and the three midfielders are very much withdrawn, so they don't have a number 10 as such. So whether he would be perhaps a plan B, perhaps if it wasn't working, then change to 4-2-3-1, and he could be the player in the hole, perhaps. But Jurgen Klopp has definitely been stuck with this 4-3-3 very rigidly, and the creative stuff comes from the front three and the two fullbacks. So he'd have to change his philosophy a bit for Alexander-Arnold to change position.
It's not just Liverpool either. Fullbacks now do affect the game as much as midfielders do. It's changed, you know. It's not like you've got Paul Scholes sitting in there spraying passes around. That's not really the way the game's played anymore. It's all about front foot dynamism, and Trent Alexander-Arnold could do both, I think. But as I say, I think, you know, the way Kevin De Bruyne gets worked into positions, that kind of little half inside space just outside the penalty box to put in crosses for Manchester City, Liverpool don't really work attacks in that way. It's about getting Alexander-Arnold can do it from fullback, but whether he would do it from midfield to quite the same extent would be, I'm not sure about that. So I think leave him where he is just now.
I do, though, like the idea of, as you said before, Bill, about all the players should be tried out in different positions, because we could have a goalkeeper being a striker and all that sort of thing. In fact, I do remember a story from my team, Brentford, when we had Wojciech Szczesny playing for us on loan from Arsenal. And for some reason, in different training sessions, he always wanted to play the striker, because obviously they never get the chance to be a striker. They're always in goal. So it does happen from time to time. There's been a number of departures in the EFL, and we thought we'd focus on Jack Ross, who's been sacked by Sunderland 18 months after he took over at the Stadium of Light. The Sunderland owner, Stuart Donald, took the decision to dismiss the former Scottish Manager of the Year, with the club in sixth place in League One following a 2-0 defeat at Lincoln City on Saturday. Sunderland lost in both the EFL Trophy final and the League One playoff final at Wembley last season, and the former St Mirren manager has only lost 10 games out of the 76 he's taken charge of in the North East. So the question is, why have they made this decision? You look at the league table, mentioned already they're sixth. They've only lost two games, Gregor. So people outside of Sunderland might be thinking, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, but inside the Stadium of Light, I think discontent was sort of brewing in the stands. It has been for a while. There's too many draws. There was kind of running joke about the one-all draws, the number of them. And it just, you know, it wasn't edgy or seat style of football really either. It's a difficult task, and he deserves credit for arresting the decline in the first place. You know, this huge sort of institution was just in free fall. And it never looked like it was too big for him. That's he deserves credit for that as well. And he's obviously proven himself to be a really good manager at St Mirren. I don't think he'll struggle to get back into work. Whether it'll be another team of that stature or not is unlikely, but certainly there'll be clubs in Scotland. And there was a lot of teams interested in him after his success at St Mirren. So I think I don't think it'll be the last we've seen of Jack Ross.
It is interesting, isn't it? As you say, the draws may have proved costly for him. I know Stuart Donald said he's taken this decision because they want promotion, and this is what he sees as the best course of action to take, Bill. But as I say, with only two defeats, outsiders will say it's pretty harsh. When you hear that and when you see the record that he has, do you think it makes the idea of going into Sunderland more difficult for others to take on, because they know that, well, the owner's pretty ruthless?
Yeah, people will know there's only one outcome. If you don't get promotion, you're out. You know, but, I mean, it's perhaps not surprising that it's only the second time in their history they've been in the third tier for successive seasons. Only the first time in their history they've been in the third tier for successive seasons, and they were historically a big club. They've had the 10th highest average attendance since the Second World War, and the same between the wars, so they go back. They're a really huge club, and the fans will just think they're in a, you know, ridiculously false position. So any sign that they're not running away with League One, they'll get agitated naturally.
As you're listening to me,
Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.